special training requirements for the Mitsubishi MU-2. What's so different about this airplane? I'm Paul Platt, and this is Aero News. Welcome into this Aero News special feature, and thanks for downloading us today. My guest today is Aero News Editor-in-Chief Jim Campbell, who, in addition to being our exalted poobah for Aero News, has also flown a whole lot of different airplanes, including the Mitsubishi MU-2, which is what we're here to talk about today. Jim, thanks for taking some time out for our listeners.
Actually, happy to be here. It's been an interesting topic for the last couple of years, and addressing it now in light of the SFAR is kind of an intriguing concept at this time.
Well, and let's get right to that story. The FAA has decided to go forward with a special federal aviation regulation covering the MU-2. Mm-hmm. And in particular, the agency wants to address training shortfalls, which it believes, after studying all the data, are the real culprit in the reputation this aircraft has acquired. Let's get a little background on the aircraft. It's a high-performance turboprop twin, was produced by Mitsubishi Heavy Industries and went out of production in 1986. And it has some quirks, or is at least demanding of pilots, to the point where it has accumulated an accident rate that many people who like the plane argue is not the plane's fault. And that reputation has been responsible in part for driving down the prices of used MU-2s to the point where people who probably shouldn't be trying to fly them are able to afford them. Is that a fair assessment?
It's a reasonable assessment of the circumstances. What it really comes down to is that the airplane was sold as one thing and delivered as another, without really informing the purchasers exactly what they were getting, that in order for Mitsubishi to put together an aircraft with this kind of performance criteria and economy, it is a very, very efficient airplane, by the way, that they decided to look outside the box, to color outside the lines, if you will, and they did. The MU-2, when it is evaluated on its merits, is a magnificent airplane. It's an airplane that I frankly think would probably still do very well in production, if not for the fact that, the market really didn't respond to it as well as the company wanted to see it responded to. And then finally, of course, there were people who just really weren't that thrilled in having to do something different for those who actually got the message that they had to.
Well, now, you have flown this airplane. What does it require you to do differently?
Well, it's a number of things, really. You've got a different kind of roll mechanism. You've got a different set of procedures and engine out. The interesting thing is it's all very intuitive when you understand the airplane. It's not a difficult airplane to fly. It's different. It's different in some ways as helicopters are different from airplanes or anything else. When you get into something that is a different criteria, you just have to take it for what it is. We saw the same kind of criteria to a certain extent in the Robinson R-22s when they came online. Everybody was used to big, heavy main rotor systems with high degrees or high amounts of mass inertia, and they get into these very light, very responsive little helicopters, which perform magnificently well, but they do so with a fairly low amount of mass inertia. So as a result, it was a different aircraft to fly in the event of an auto rotation. A very different aircraft to fly. Now, the nice part is when you know it, it's, you know, easy as falling off a log or something like that. And once an SFAR was also established for the Robinson series and people started taking the training in that aircraft far more seriously, the accident rate plummeted, as it should have. It's just a magnificent little helicopter.
Well, has this problem been with the MU-2 since its beginning? Because if I understand correctly, if I look at some of the accident reports that have come out in the last couple of years, there was one right at my home airport, Hillsboro, Oregon, a couple of years ago where a guy and his wife were taking another couple out to dinner. They were going to fly down to Salem to eat at the flight deck restaurant there, and apparently suffered a left engine failure on takeoff. Mm-hmm. And could not handle the aircraft. This guy had 4,000 hours logged as a pilot, but had only owned the aircraft for 30 days. Is this a typical profile?
Bingo.
I mean,
this
looked like, if you'll excuse the expression, an accident waiting to happen?
I hate to say it really was. You know, it's interesting. The adherence of the airplane, the people who have been out there know it and own them and love them. And frankly, The one good thing about all this is that the market on these things is in the toilet. You can find some really good deals on MU-2s, and if and when we're in a position to start going turboprop, that's an airplane I'd very seriously consider. But at the same time, I'd also make sure that I and anybody else flying it is going to be trained and trained properly, not just in the rudiments of high-performance aircraft, but in this particular high-performance aircraft. Learn to fly the airplane. The airplane will treat you just fine. There isn't anything this airplane can't do as well or better than most in its class. And more important to a lot of people, it was just a really well-designed, very thoroughly thought-out airplane. But once again, they colored outside the lines. If anything, if you can criticize Mitsubishi for anything, it was overestimating the intelligence of the pilots who got into this and not taking it seriously as a uniquely different type of aircraft. That's all.
Is this something that's common in aviation? I have to stand back and look at this and say that...
Oh, man. You don't want to know.
Well, one of the things that I noticed, because, as you know, my introduction to aviation was an interest in experimental gyroplanes. And the story in that segment is that is a classic case of people not taking it seriously. And one of the big problems, one of the big risk groups in gyroplanes is, 10,000-hour ATPs getting one to fly on the weekend, because they come from a world in which everything has been made so safe and sure that anything different is maybe not recognized. I mean, people get into an environment after a career in aviation where things have to be done differently or there are risks that they're not familiar with, I'm not sure that they're set up well to accept those risks.
Well, Paul, you hit the nail on the head. You really did. Yet another good example. I use the Robinson using gyros is a perfect example of people not taking the type of aircraft seriously. And you and I both know that gyros are some of the simplest flying aircraft on the face of the planet. It's the only, most are some of the only naturally stable rotorcraft in the fleet. Mm-hmm. They're very easy to fly. They're very responsive. They're a lot of fun. But don't take them seriously, and they will bite you in the behind and take a good chunk out of you while they're at it. I have watched some very accomplished rotorcraft pilots get into a gyro, take a minimum of instruction, think they've got it licked, and not even get off the ground because they start flapping the rotor in the process of taking off and not taking all the little lessons that they should have been taught or should have learned seriously. Thankfully, most of them don't get off the ground, but for those who don't take it seriously. But for those that do, consequences can be pretty rude.
In the second half of this, I want to get into some of the training specifics that the FAA is proposing. But before we take our break, what is it specifically you have to look at differently when you get into an MU-2?
I'll tell you what, why don't we hit that one after the break here,
okay.
Because there's actually a fair amount to this.
All right. We're talking to Jim Campbell, who is editor-in-chief at Aero News Network and has tens of hours, at least in the MU-2, among the many other planes he's flown. And we're going to talk more about this SFAR from the FAA in just a moment. I'm Paul Plack. You're listening to a special feature from Aero News.
Uncramp your style in a new Citation CJ2 Plus from Cessna. Now with integrated ProLine 21 avionics, FADEC, and a restyled cockpit and cabin. In the CJ2 Plus, you'll carry more payload than you could in the original CJ2. You'll climb and cruise faster. You'll have the freedom to use even shorter runways, and you'll do it all on less fuel. For a sure thing, call 1-800-4-CESSNA.
Diamond's DA-42 Twin Star is General Aviation's ultimate flying machine. Fly fast with the confidence of a twin for the cost of a single. Go direct over water or rugged terrain and cover great distances in the first and only piston aircraft with an advanced airframe, avionics, and engines. The DA-42 gives you options you've never had before, including the Garmin G1000 and known ice protection. Go where you want, when you want, fast and for less. Visit Diamond on the web at www.diamondair.com or call 888-359-3220.
Welcome back to this Aero News special feature. I'm Paul Platt, talking today with Jim Campbell, Aero News Editor-in-Chief, about the Mitsubishi MU-2. The twin turboprop has developed a reputation for being hard to handle. Proponents of the plane say it's an undeserved reputation, but the FAA is now going to publish an SFAR, imposing some unique training requirements on anyone who will want to fly one. Jim, we wanted to talk a little bit about the training requirements that the FAA is imposing on pilots who will fly the MU-2. But I wanted to talk first a little bit about what is it specifically that's different about this plane. I was talking earlier today with a flight instructor who spent much of his early career flying around in MU-2s for charter flights. Mm-hmm. He has about 700 hours in the plane. He said he hated it for the first 100 hours he flew it, and after that he loved it. But he said it is somewhat unforgiving of errors in judgment regarding airspeed and a number of other things.
Well, there's a number of things. You got to remember there's a couple of really, well, let's call it what it is, oddball elements to this airplane. But let's tackle a couple things first. Keep in mind that this, even the short-body MU-2Bs, were 300-knot airplanes, 315 in some cases. I think the Solitaires and the higher-end stuff did well over 320. So this is a fast little motor scooter. This little puppy will book along. So decisions need to be made with such things in mind. Part of the problem with a lot of these accidents is that these people were way behind the airplane. The old joke is, you know, that whatever befell them happened 20 minutes after the airplane hit the ground because they were so far behind it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and on top of it, you know, once again, it's a high-altitude airplane. It does fine in the 20s, which means that it's an airplane that will often be operated hard IFR, hard ice, and so forth. It's got a full-span, double-slotted Fowler flap that does some amazing things when extended. I mean, it actually increases the wing area by almost a quarter, if I remember correctly, when the Fowler flaps are fully extended. That's a lot of drag.
Uh-huh.
So having flaps out in an asymmetric power configuration, yet another thing that you're going to have to deal with. You have spoilers for primary roll control. Spoilers are a different ball game entirely. Keep in mind that you're instead of a standard configuration aileron, which is changing the lift vector, what you're doing here is you're literally spoiling the lift over the wing to change the roll format. So there's a number of different things to think about in an engine failure scenario. Speed is life in any of these airplanes, but more so in the MU-2. I'd rather just keep going straight ahead. It will accelerate very nicely on one engine. It does very well on one engine. But, you know, to keep in mind, once again, that because of the fact that you've got spoilers on the aircraft, it's a different type of control. Because of these huge Fowler flaps, that's a different thing to deal with as well. So it's a different set of decision-making is what it comes down to. But once again, the big thing is it's a high-performance airplane. People operated them in ice, lots of ice. People operated them fast, very fast. And in most cases, people were way behind the airplane. And the MU-2 was an airplane that just wasn't taken seriously. That's the part that drives me nuts. This was a great little airplane. It was an extraordinary event at the time when it came out. It has engine out. It's actually pretty mild. You'd be surprised at how well the aircraft does one engine out. But like anything else, you've just got to understand the airplane. The one thing I will criticize it for, if you want to do that, was there was not a whole lot of aerodynamic stall warning. And to make a long story short, it was just one of those things where you had to stay on the airplane, know the airplane, and where just a little bit of familiarity was wonderful. I mean, think about this. You know, in a standard engine out situation, you got to clean it up. You got to do this. You got to do that. In the MU-2, you want to keep the flaps extended until you get a little bit of altitude. You don't touch it. You want that lift. You got to get the gear up, but also keep in mind that the gear on that has a lot of drag through the gear retraction cycle. So one more thing to keep in mind and to think about as you're planning your ability to get out of whatever trouble you're in.
Well, I skimmed through the 216-page PDF file that is this report on the notice on the comments received during the rulemaking process. About half of the report is diagrams and instructional material that's to be used in acquainting pilots with the unique features and reactions of the aircraft. So let's run through what the FAA wants for training time and see if this lines up.
Okay.
That was one of the criticisms that the FAA received from its original proposal. in especially the recurrent area. If you want a recurrent training in the MU-2, they want you to have 8 hours on the ground and 4 in the aircraft or 6 in the simulator. Is this a burdensome thing for somebody who has been flying this plane a lot?
You know, be honest, I can't really tell you at this point. What we've been doing hasn't been working. I think the smartest thing that can happen right now with the SFAR is to see what happens over the course of the next 2 or 3 years and then adjust to fit. If we see a significant change overall in the accident rate, if we hear from pilots that it's too much, it's not enough, pilots, especially once they're confronted with the reality of owning this aircraft, are going to fess up pretty quick as to whether or not they think they are or they aren't equipped, especially with an SFAR out. SFAR means you've got to take it seriously.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, in terms of initial training, just looking at the training materials that are proposed in this report, the initial or transition training of 20 hours of ground instruction and 12 in flight instruction, a minimum of 6 of which has to be in the aircraft itself, not in a simulator.
Mm-hmm.
If anything, that looks like it might not be enough to cover the material.
Agreed. Agreed. Yeah, part of the problem with an SFAR like this was controversial because let's face what happened here. A lot of this was driven by politics. A couple of folks went out, took a look at an accident rate, did not look at everything that was happening, and decided to make a really big deal out of something that, well, in the case of one politician, I know he didn't understand it that well based on what he was saying about it and some of the language that he used in describing the aircraft. At one point, one politician was trying to get the type certificate totally revoked.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that when it was a political football, the best that we could have hoped for was a reasonable rule. The rule doesn't look totally out of the question right now. The FAA has learned a few things from SFARs, especially after the Robinson incident quite a few years ago and mm-hmm. such. So, you know, right now, I think. From what I'm seeing, it's not a bad place to start. There's some areas here where it seems like too much, some areas where it seems not enough, but SFARs are not published permanently. They
right.
are published for a specific period of time, and they're either renewed or not renewed, depending on the conditions, or modified to suit.
Do you think that what has happened with the MU-2's track record and reputation over the last 20 years has had an effect on other aircraft coming to market? Do people think twice before they think outside the box now?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a dirty shame. It really is. I mean, you know, let's look at what's happened out here. We had somebody in the last few years really do something unusual in the business jet arena, VLJs in particular. And you'd have thought that this guy was trying to take advantage of your sister. I mean, it was by saying and doing things that everybody said you could not do or should not do or wasn't the way everybody was doing, this fellow, rightly or wrongly, got clobbered. We're talking about Verg Rayburn, of course.
Mm-hmm.
That's a bit milder example of what we're talking here, but the minute anybody starts thinking outside the box, the industry, which is very conservative, let's call it ultra-conservative, tends to get up on its high horse and say, you can't do it because we can't do it.
Right. Well, and, you know, I have to think that this kind of conservatism and knowing that you're going to hit this wall if you try to turn in a different direction
mm-hmm.
may be why, for example, we're stuck with engine technology, which looks a lot like the stuff our grandfathers flew.
Boy, ain't that the truth.
Well, Jim, listen, we appreciate your insight. It's always good to talk to somebody who's flown a lot of different airplanes to get that perspective.
I have no problem in stating an aircraft's got, you know, positives and negatives. And you know, the MU-2 series was an interesting series of compromises, but when you take a look at the overall plan form, this really was a very interesting, intriguing, and sleek little airplane.
Well, and with propellers refusing to go quietly in the jet age and carving out a nice little niche for themselves, thank you very much, it would have been interesting had things been different over time to see what this aircraft might be doing in the marketplace today.
Indeed.
Jim, as always, thanks. Appreciate your thoughts.
Take care.
Jim Campbell is ANN's editor-in-chief, and you've been listening to a special feature from Aero News. Find us on the web at www.aero.net. I'm Paul Plack. Thanks for listening. Have a clear and unlimited day.